Good afternoon. Nicely done. It's nice to be back. I have no idea how many times I've been here. Six or seven, we think. But it's good to be back and to be working with Sarah and Gaydon and Chris, and to begin an afternoon devoted largely to melody, because we are talking about Richard Rodgers and his work primarily with, as you know, Lorenz Hart and Oscar Hammerstein. If Jerome Kern was the greatest writer of melody for the Broadway musical, perhaps in all of our popular music, then Richard Rodgers ran him a very close second. He seemed to have a bottomless font of music, of melodic music, from which to draw for 30 or 40 years or more. He was also an unusually flexible writer. Do you know that during the time that Rodgers was writing, the first half of the 20th century, what we have come to call the Great American Songbook? By the way, they didn't know that term. When Richard Rodgers sat down to write a melody, he did not say to himself, "Oh, wonderful, I'm making another contribution to the Great American Songbook." He didn't know he was doing that. It's a latter day and slightly self-serving term that those of us interested in it use to make ourselves sound important. It's also accurate. These are, at least as a body of song, in my view and in the view of others, I think, an unequaled body of song. Always great songwriters, always, but not so many at the height of their powers for so long as during these years. Most of these songs were written collaboratively. It was an age of specialization. There was a composer, and there was a lyricist, and there was an arranger, and there was a musician, or two, or five, or 12, and there was a music director, and. It was perhaps unconsciously modeled on Henry Ford's conveyor belt. Well, it was an age of industrialization in which everybody contributed a part. It was the way the culture organized itself. And so Richard Rodgers wrote the music, and then his lyricist wrote the words. In probably 90% or more of the songs written at the time, the music came first, and then the lyrics. What makes Rodgers an unusually flexible writer is that with Hart, like with everyone else, the music came first. And then Hart added the words. But in 1943, when he started to work with Hammerstein, Rodgers learned that Oscar preferred to write the words first. And so Richard Rodgers said, "Okay," and that was it. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's also not as easy to make things fresh as it sounds. Yip Harburg, who should know about such things? You all know who Yip Harburg is. Yes, the words to Over the Rainbow. As I've said before, if you think Harold Arlen wrote Over the Rainbow, you only get to hum the melody, you don't get to sing the words. Yip Harburg wrote the words to all the songs for Wizard of Oz and many other things as well. He said this: "Feeding a composer an idea, a title, is fine. But usually if you give him a complete lyric first, a banal melody results." Not with Richard Rodgers. To underscore the point, we're going to begin with two songs. First, a Hammerstein lyric that feels as if Lorenz Hart wrote it, and then a Lorenz Hart lyric that feels as if Oscar Hammerstein could have written it.
The boss gets on my nerves. I drive with my time.
One reason you have to do a song like that at the beginning of a Richard Rodgers show is because he wrote such wonderful waltzes. He is perhaps the great writer of waltzes for the American musical. Hart and Hammerstein were born in the same year, in 1895, and Rodgers was born 7 years later. He was the junior partner, at least chronologically. They all went to Columbia, but not to get an education. They went to Columbia to work on the musicals. In those years, students mounted musicals, sometimes original shows, original reviews, like The Hasty Pudding at Harvard and so on. And so it was a chance to write. And they were interested in writing for the theater, and so they took themselves up to Columbia, where they wrote. Hart and Rodgers wrote together, they hoped it was professionally. For a number of years after college, they did so with notable lack of success. They would place a song here or there and then go for a very long time with nothing but rejection. They were finally about to break up the partnership. Richard Rodgers' father, who was a prominent physician in the city, had arranged for his son to get a job in the garment business. I believe it was in ladies' gloves. And at about the time that Rodgers was about to go downtown and tell the owner of this business that, yes, he would be coming to work on Monday, they got a call from a new, struggling, but aspiring and ambitious theater production company called the Theater Guild that said it was going to put on a review, which they would call Garrett Gaieties of 1925, and asked if Rodgers and Hart would write the score. They did, of course, and that's what truly started their career and gave them their first hit song, which I will not insult you by naming.
Thank you.
That doesn't sound like a patter song. You know, patter songs are quick and bouncy, and they're really simply musical settings for witty lyrics, and the songs are about the lyrics. A song like You're the Top, for example. And yet this one has the most lilting, Rodgers-like melody, buoying up that slightly irreverent lyric by Lorenz Hart. The collaboration with Hammerstein doesn't begin until 1943. Hart lived, as I think you know, a tortured life. He was a closeted gay man at a time when gay men were closeted, and never came to grips with it. He was an alcoholic. He hated to work. He was a dreadful procrastinator. He truly was tortured. He felt no one loved him. He felt his work was worthless. He's almost an invitation to amateur psychologize. And yet he wrote this extraordinary stuff. But by the early 40s, it was pretty clear that he was finding it increasingly difficult to work in all ways, not only to do the work, but to show up. He would disappear for weeks at a time, go on these terrible benders, and wake up in a hotel room somewhere and not know how he got there. And so Rodgers, ever the practical man, decided that he had better start looking around for a new collaborator. And he wrote a letter to Hammerstein saying that if it happened that Hart could no longer work, would he be interested? And it comes at an interesting time because here is Rodgers' career in a sense in upheaval. He doesn't have his collaborator of some 20 years anymore. And here's Hammerstein, who's written with Kern 4 or 5 flops in a row and has fled to Hollywood because he doesn't know if he has a career left. You know, these people that we think of as having these remarkable successes lived on roller coasters. You're only as good as your last hit. And it was a bad time for Kern and Hammerstein. The coming together then obviously was fortuitous. But Oklahoma was uncharted territory, and it was tricky, and was it going to work? And did they have a career left? And Oscar Hammerstein had already been writing for Broadway for 25 years. And was it over? He'd made his name in operetta. He wrote the lyrics for The Desert Song, for Rosemarie, for New Moon. His name brings to mind not what we think of as, originally brings to mind, not Oklahoma and Carousel, but these grand romantic ballads with music by people like Sigmund Romberg. Here's an example.
Thank you.
After Garrick Aedes, Rodgers and Hart had a number of successes right in a row. By the late 20s, they had written four, five, six shows, all hits, and they were sick to death of them. Not of the hits, but anytime somebody wanted something youthful, they would go to Rodgers and Hart, and they were tired of being pegged. They were tired of being cornered, and yet there was a reason for it because of the things they were writing. Rodgers' songs with Lorenz Hart do feel eager and youthful. Maybe it's because of what the market would bear. Maybe it's because Rodgers himself was a young man. The songs with Oscar Hammerstein feel more romantic, more reflective. Is that because times have changed? Is it because musical styles have changed? Is it because they're older? Is it because of the kind of people Hart and Hammerstein were? And so Rodgers was composing different kinds of melodies. I don't have an answer, but I sure do seem to have a lot of questions. Either way, take these next two songs, one casual, one confessional, one with a lyric by Hart, one with a lyric by Hammerstein, and yet both have those lovely, lilting Rodgers melodies.
Change your new wine to old, for I can do such wonders.
Here are two songs on a similar subject to give you a sense of how different the songs were by Rodgers and Hart as opposed to Rodgers and Hammerstein. The subject of these songs is spring. Obviously, there are thousands of songs to choose from. The one by Rodgers and Hart announces that spring has arrived, and that is typically an opportunity, a setting for something joyful, something happy, something feeling liberated. Not when Lorenz Hart gets his hands on it. Hart's lyrics are a series of mournful questions that create a bittersweet melancholy, which is perhaps, in love ballads, Hart's most characteristic stance. His outlook on love was not cynical, but certainly skeptical, and perhaps the best word to use about it is bittersweet. Rodgers provides him with a melody that's dusky, a musical setting for questions that have no answers. Oscar Hammerstein had a problem. He had to write a song that was set in summertime, and he couldn't find a way to say what he wanted to say, and so he ended up writing a spring song for summer. It's from the movie State Fair, and it's not what you might have been expecting from Hammerstein. It's not the large aria-like celebration of spring's joys, because the character who's singing it is unhappy. This is the part played by Jean Crane. She's She's down. Everybody's up looking for the state to the state fair, and she could care less. She's just in a mood. I think it is not pushing a point too far that she's to say that she's an adolescent with a vengeance, 1945 version. They have to give her a song to sing. And Hammerstein comes up with an idea but doesn't think it'll work because it's summertime and it's about spring. And he reads the lyric to Rogers, who says, "It's perfect, that's it," and sets the melody to the lyric. It feels enervated, as if you've got spring fever, even though it's July or August. It's the innocent romanticism at which Hammerstein excelled. That is, the early in their career, he wrote these large songs and continued to. But we come to think of him for the songs with Rogers, the love songs with Rogers, which really were very romantic and very innocent. Think of a song like Younger Than Springtime, for example. If you know what the lyric is, the song, by the way, is "It Might As Well Be Spring." If you know the lyric, I know I feel this way, I feel that way, it might as well be spring. If you know what's coming in the lyric, you can listen to the music. And you can listen to the way in which Rogers, at the beginning of the song, creates an unsettled feel. It isn't all a jangle. That's not the style of the character. But there's an unsettled feeling. But as the lyric becomes more reflective, as this young woman thinks more deeply about how she feels, about what she's going through right now, you'll find that the lyric line, in response to this reflectiveness, the lyrical line becomes longer and more lyrical. That is, Rogers, without beating you over the head with a stick, is shaping his music to the mood of the lyric. Richard Rogers did not like jazz. He didn't like it because jazz musicians changed what he wrote. And lots of composers don't like people who change. I still get annoyed when I think about it. It's a small thing, but it irritates me. Frank Sinatra, who to his credit, would always mention the name of the lyricist when he performed. A lot of singers would get up and say, here's a wonderful Harold Arlen tune, never mentioning the fact that Johnny Mercer wrote the lyric. He would always mention the lyric, and then he would change the lyric when he sang the song. In Ladies of Tramp, he changed women to broad because he was such a cool guy, and things like that. So Rodgers didn't like jazz. In fact, he and Lorenz Hart wrote a song, I think it was in 38, called I Like to Recognize the Tune. He once threatened, some years later, to sue the Marcells, the doo-wop group. They made a recording of Blue Moon that he detested until he found out how much it earned. Peggy Lee made a recording of Lover in 1954, a very, very stylized version, in no way in feel like the original song. It was a product of the recording studio and the pushing of buttons. When he heard it, he said this, I don't know why Peggy picked on me when she could have fucked up Silent Night. Richard Rodgers, 1954. He once said, this isn't a matter of inspiration. It isn't a question of sitting on top of a hill and waiting for inspiration to strike. It's work. That I like. Only the very young think you wait for inspiration, but they don't have to get anything done. If we all waited for inspiration, that we would have much less than we have. You force it, and some days it works. People have said, this is Rodgers, people have said, you're a genius. I say, no, it's my job. I like that too. His daughter said she never saw her father play the piano for pleasure. And we were talking about that before, and Gayden suggested that if playing the piano was your work, then why would you do it when you're not working, especially if the work is intense? Busman's Holiday. Playing piano was not recreation for Richard Rodgers. He was, in fact, a distant man. He was not warm and fuzzy at all. He was a womanizer, an alcoholic, and a great songwriter. Don't confuse character with talent. They are not the same thing. God gets the credit for the talent. You get the credit for the behavior. Lorenz Hart was a tortured soul whose ebullient manner was the opposite of Rodgers. He was also an alcoholic, as I said before, a closeted homosexual. He stood just over 5 feet tall. He had a case of mild dwarfism. His head was very large, the body rather small. And again, he believed his work was of no value. In the early 40s, when it became clear that Hart couldn't work much anymore, that he was moving toward a physical and emotional collapse, Rodgers contacts Hammerstein. Now, we all know that Hammerstein wrote this sweetly romantic material, but he was a sophisticated man and a worldly man who chose a point of view. It isn't that the point of view was phony. It's that the man was more than his point of view in the songs, that he was more than what you say in a 32-bar song. And so he chose this perspective, and the success that he had suggests that it was genuine, but clearly was not the whole man. And then, of course, the career flopped, and he and Rodgers ultimately come together. I want you to hear two typical love songs, one by Rodgers and Hart, one by Rodgers and Hammerstein, one implicitly erotic, the other ardently romantic. Mm-hmm. 1943, the year of Oklahoma, is one of the dividing lines in the history of the American musical. Before that, we have something called musical comedy. Now, I understand that for many people, the term musical comedy is a generic term. It means anything from the Garrick Gaieties to Phantom of the Opera. I apologize for you saying that in this room. But in fact, the musical comedy is a kind of musical, the kind that appears before 1943 that Oklahoma changes. What to call it? The musical play, the integrated musical, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. Musical comedy is notable for its relatively slapdash stories, its corny jokes, its long-legged chorus girls, its fast pace, its wackiness, and its wonderful songs. What Rodgers and Hammerstein bring to the musical is an element of coherence. Everything has to serve the telling of that story, not only the book, but the songs, which are now expected to advance the plot or create the character. The dance, the background music, everything is supposed to contribute rather than just being a series of sometimes disparate elements that we can paste together in an entertaining chunk. And the result is not only a touch of realism, but even a trace of psychological complexity. Think about characters like Judge Fry in Oklahoma and Billy Bigelow in Carousel. We now understand that what Rodgers and Hammerstein gave us, and other songwriting teams, Lerner and Lowe, for example, picked up on, was a new kind of operetta. It was no longer about the Prince of Ruritania and a barmaid. They were set largely in America, and they were about ordinary Americans. They were, if you will, democratic operettas, ordinary operettas, because they were about ordinary people. Who could be more ordinary than Curly and Laurie? But they are rooted, and they are rooted, in the lives of ordinary Americans. Back at the beginning of the program today, we did a song by heart that felt Hammerstein-y, and vice versa. Not here. The first is pure Oscar. The second is unmistakable Larry. Both are about troubles with love. Hammerstein's because you're innocent, and Heart's because you're not.
I know a way to prove what they say is quite untrue.
How do you resist a song that has in it a line like "the self-deception that believes the lie"? In a song, my goodness, quite remarkable. Rodgers and Hammerstein did not write a lot about sex, more's the pity, especially in the super clean 40s and 50s. But Hart loved to be naughty. He loved to get things past the censors and was doubly pleased if he could do it in a breezy sort of way. Many of you know the song Bewitched, or Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, which was a big hit in 1954. And that's probably when we heard it. Because in 1954, I was 18 years old, so I'd have heard it on the radio, right? And since you're either much younger or much older than I, you also would have heard it on the radio. And it was very popular. It was a hit. Except it wasn't the original version of Bewitched that Rodgers and Hart wrote. I said that there was a dividing line in 1943, and there was. But nothing simply comes out of the blue. Things exist before that are paving the way, even if we don't know it. Showboat in 1927 did everything that Oklahoma did in terms of integrating materials, but didn't have a great deal of effect. People went back to doing what they'd done. In 1940, Rodgers and Hart wrote a very dark musical called Pal Joey, which has the first real anti-hero in the Broadway musical, Joey, who was a real louse. Joey's only quality is that he's good in bed. But he really is a dreadful person. And Vera, the middle-aged woman who is his muse, isn't that nice? she puts up the money for the nightclub because they're having an affair and he's great in the sack. Is quite content knowing what he is because she's having more fun than she's had in many years. Now, that's not what you would expect to hear on the radio in the 1950s. That show's from 1940. It flopped. It was ahead of its time. It didn't open and close the way so many have done, the way so many do now. You know, a show today either runs 3 performances or 30,000 performances. There's no such thing as just a good evening in the theater anymore, at least in musicals. The result is that it did not do well, and this song was not played on the radio as originally written, because one would not have then. When it was reopened, it was revived in 1954 with the original Vera, the original middle-aged woman. Vivian Siegel recreated the role. And instead of the original Joey, the louse, he wasn't around to play it because his name was Gene Kelly and he'd gone to Hollywood. It was the show, it was his first and only Broadway show, and it got him the contract. And if you've ever seen his first Hollywood movie, you're a ringer, though. You're a ringer. Anyone know? Yet, For Me and My Gal. And they put Judy Garland in to make sure it was okay, because he was an unknown, so they teamed him up with Judy Garland. And they did that wonderful arrangement of For Me and My Gal, which was written in 1917. It's a World War I song. And so Kelly wasn't around. But the character he played, that gentleman knows the movie, the character he played in For Me and My Gal was a heel. He was playing Joey, basically, in the movie, except it had a happy ending, because how do you turn your back on Judy Garland? And have I got it right so far? Anyway, they hired Harold Lang, who was a good, solid Broadway hoofer, basically, singer and dancer. And the show was much more successful. The world had changed a little bit. And Bewitched became a hit record, but they had to clean the words up to play it on the radio. And so you grew up not even knowing you didn't hear the real words. And aren't you glad you're here today? Because you're going to hear the naughty words. It's a big day for us. You're old enough now, yes.
Have your little
The first rule of writing a comic song's lyric is to make it not too funny. Do you know why? Can you figure it out? If you start laughing, you stop listening. And so it's to amuse rather than to produce belly laughs. Richard Rodgers wrote more than 900 songs for 43 Broadway musicals. After Oscar Hammerstein died, he never had another hit. Hammerstein died in 1960. In 1962, Rodgers decided that he would write his own lyrics, and he wrote both for an interracial love story called No Strings, starring Diane Carroll and Richard Kiley. Soon after that, he worked with a young man for whom Hammerstein had been a surrogate father and teacher, and I assume you know who that was, Stephen Sondheim. Sondheim's sardonic urban wit, even when he was young, inspired Rodgers to do something he had sometimes done with heart. He wrote a melody that was the direct opposite of what the lyric was saying. And once again, working with Sondheim, young Sondheim, it worked. So here are lyrics by Stephen Sondheim and then lyrics by Richard Rodgers.
Sad to say that I
Thank you. Thank you. Before we do an encore, we have come to the commercial portion of the program. I did a book in 2006, and you're looking at me like I'm... Oh, okay. I thought I'd aired. I did a book signing here after a program when it was new. Philip Fury and I wrote the book called America Songs, and it's the story of how some 300 American songs came to be written, how and why. So it's an anecdotal history, really of collaboration, except for the few songwriters who did not collaborate, most notably Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. And then about 3 years later, I contacted Phil because that book we originally had a list of some 700 songs for, and we had to eliminate because publishers don't say, sure, do what you want anymore. And I sent an email to Phil and said, you want to do the rest of the songs in another volume? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, why not? He had just finished a book, and he needed some time away. So I said, okay, if I go ahead, he said, sure. So the second book is out. The first song was called America's Songs The Stories Behind the Songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley. Did we have that one? Yeah, okay. The second volume, the publisher name. You know, publishers get to name your book. You don't get to name your book, the publisher. And I came up with these jazzy titles, but my editor, who was a terrific person with the unlikely name of Constance Ditzel, said, we're going to call it America's Songs 2. So it's called America's Songs 2. The subtitle is From the 1890s to the Postwar Years. Both songs basically go from, both books rather, basically go from 1900 to 1950. The first one actually sneaks forward to 1977, and the second one sneaks back to 1891. But they're basically about the songs of the Great American Songbook. They are both for sale, and I will be happy if you would like to stop and say hello, and I will be even happier if you buy a copy of either or both. They make splendid stocking stuffers, especially in large quantities. Do you know what they cost? Is there a sign up? There's a sign up. Okay. End of commercial. We can go back to work now. In 1879, Richard Rodgers died. What did I say? Yes, thank you. Good. Did I really? Okay. He died in 1979. Before that, he had a series of shows that were flops, one after the other. But one of them, from 1978, 77, a terrible flop. It really died. But it had one song in it that I've become very fond of, that I think reaffirms Richard Rodgers' gift for melody. His lyricist was Sheldon Harnick, who was a splendid lyricist. For those of you who may not be familiar with the name, anyone not? He wrote the lyrics to Fiorello, She Loves Me, Fiddler on the Roof, The Rothschilds. His composer was Jerry Bock. Sheldon believes, by the way, Gayden and Sarah and I all know Sheldon. He's a wonderful man. Sheldon believed when he got started that he needed to be a wit. And his mentor was Yip Harburg, who was one of the wittiest of song lyricists. I will tell you again my favorite little couplet of Yip's. It's from a book of light verse that he wrote. To let a fool kiss you is stupid. To let a kiss fool you is worse. That's pure Yip. It's pure Yip. My hearing apparently is no better than yours. To let a fool kiss you is stupid. To let a fool, I'm going to do it again. To let a fool kiss you is stupid. To let a kiss fool you is worse. He loved those kinds of things. It's called choresis or chorisis. It's a Greek name for a figure of speech. When I'm not near the girl I love the girl I'm near. Same thing. Yip loved those. Sheldon started out writing these very witty songs, but he struggled with love songs. He had great trouble making love songs that were love songs and still be witty, and somehow it went against the grain. And the longer he wrote, the more he came not to lose his admiration for Porter and Harburg, but to have his admiration grow for those who wrote the simplest yet most touching lyrics, Irving Berlin, Oscar Hammerstein. This song is in that spirit. Rex flopped badly, so we've pretty much forgotten the score. You know, when shows are lousy, they drag good scores, at least good songs, down with them. This is a case of that, I think. It's a good reminder of Richard Rodgers' gift for pure lyrical music. Please listen as a way of saying thank you for coming to a song called Away From You.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.